Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm really excited to have with me today Dr. David Mazur, who gave grand rounds here at Hopkins this morning. It was a fantastic presentation. Many of you probably know Dr. Mazur's name. He's a professor at the University of Toronto and is incredibly well-published in many areas, most specifically and recently, the PI on the TRIX3 trial, which was a transfusion trigger in cardiac surgery trial published in the New England Journal. Really interesting, and gave a great talk about transfusion triggers and about kind of lessons he's learned in his career and life so far that was really well received. And so we decided that if we were lucky, and we are lucky enough to have him sit down to do a little extra talking on the topic. So, Dr. Mazur, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So why don't we start off a little bit just talking about you. You've had a very successful and continue to have a very successful ongoing career in many ways, but especially in research. And I tell our listeners a little bit about how you got where you are and any recommendation or advice you have for people who may be in med school or in training and thinking, you know, I would love one day to be able to publish a New England Journal article.
Sure. So I had grown up in Saskatchewan in the prairies of Canada. And when I finished medical school, I didn't actually know what I had wanted to do. So if you'd asked me at that point where I'd end up in my career, I would never have predicted this to be the place that I'd end up. So a lot of my career ended up being serendipitous. I did an internship and found that the anesthesiologists were the people that seemed to have the most interesting practice and the most interesting life and could talk about things outside of medicine. So I thought that would be something I'd like to pursue. But before I did that, I did some general practice in places north of the Arctic Circle. I was a doctor in Tuktoyaktuk. I did locums in New Zealand, and I practiced in Saskatchewan doing general practice, and then decided to pursue a career in anesthesia. So I did my anesthesia residency in Toronto and came across a mentor who's been a mentor of mine my entire life. And he encouraged me to do research training, which I did at the University of California in San Francisco. And then I came back up to that point, or prior to anesthesia research, I had prior to me embarking on my anesthesia training and the fellowship, I had not done any research. In fact, if you look at my CV, I don't have a PhD. I don't have a Master's of Public Health. I don't have a Master's of Science. In fact, I don't even have a Bachelor of Science degree. All I have is an MD degree. But what I've had in my career is a lot of curiosity, some great mentorship, some opportunity, and some luck thrown in as well. And of those, I think the two most important are probably curiosity and mentorship.
Yeah, that's great. And I was struck by that when you said this morning that you had no formal research training prior to residency. And I think that actually could be really intriguing for people out there who may think, oh, you know, I'm not an MD PhD, so that is not open to me. And I asked you this when we were just chatting before we went on the air, but I'll ask you again now because I think folks might want to hear it. You know, if you were talking to med students and they had the option of, let's say, working a year of research training in, do you recommend that? Do you think it's helpful to have that training if people have the option?
I think it is helpful to have training related to research or the research that you might be interested in doing. I gained my knowledge about research along the way. I learned as I went, or I engaged others who had that expertise to help me along the way. But if one does know that they want to pursue a research career, for sure having some training related to research, whether it's a a clinical epidemiology degree, an MD, PhD, or something like that, gives you an edge and also allows you to progress a little bit further. But as I said, I had no training whatsoever related to research, and I was fortunate to have the opportunity and the mentorship to help me get where I am.
Yeah, and I think that's the message is, you know, if folks are interested, it's still possible. You just have to find the right mentors and have the curiosity and learn from people as you go. So let's talk just a little about the idea that the TRIX3 trial was a huge international trial and seems very daunting, I think, to people, even who are doing some research, to think about doing something like that. So what advice do you have for people who might think, you know, I'd be interested in one day running an international trial? What kind of skills would they want to develop or thought processes they want to have to be able to get to that point?
So I think one needs to start by looking at questions that are really important to you, but also really important to patients and really important to funding agencies, because to do a large trial requires a lot of work by a lot of people. So those people need to share the vision that you have or the importance of the question that you want to address. In addition, it does require significant resources, and for granting agencies or your universities or your practice partners to support that along the way, they need to understand the importance of the question and really want to know the answer. And I think while it is important to think big, I started small. And I started with small questions, and I started with addressing questions that I could answer in a smaller fashion or a simplistic way. And also, I think collaborating with others is important. In fact, TRIX3 started because the hematologist who I'm a co-PI with came to me after she finished her training and said she wanted to do a master's degree and could we do something related to transfusion. And so I said, sure, we could do this master's degree together. We did a survey of transfusion, and after that was completed, we decided that maybe we should look at something more interventional related to transfusion practice. So we did TRIX1, which was a small study at our own hospital. Again, Nadine was instrumental in leading TRIX1 and encouraging me along the way. And from there, we went on to TRIX2 and TRIX3, engaged other partners, were fortunate enough to get funded from major funding agencies, and had the commitment and engagement of a wide variety of people around the world who really wanted to know the answer to the question. And fortunately, we were successful in being able to answer it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. If you had to say, what would you say is the most challenging part of running that kind of a trial?
There are many challenges along the way that become most challenging at different times of the life of the trial. The most challenging part probably relates to getting the engagement of everyone who's going to support the trial. And again, that's the patients, the funders, the institutions, the ethics boards, and all your partners. Because for a trial like this to succeed, there needs to be continued commitment to answering the question. And whether that's personal commitment or financial commitment or time commitment, it is essential for success.
Yeah, and you mentioned this morning this was a 10-year process of your life from planning to publication.
Well,
right?
From the time that Nadine first came to me and said, let's do a transfusion project together,
yeah,
until TRIX3 is probably about 10 years.
Yeah, so you have to have patience and fortitude to, yes, make it through that kind of a process.
Yes, it's a long-term thing. And that is, I think, one of the issues related to research is that in some respects, research related to anesthesia is very different than clinical practice in anesthesia. So in clinical practice in anesthesia, we are taught to be risk averse. But in research, you actually have to take risks and you have to explore new areas or do things in a way that people haven't done before. And then you mentioned the time horizon. Within clinical practice in anesthesia, the time horizons are very short, you know, cases or days, but the time horizon for research is longer, measured in months or years. And then finally, the other difference between clinical practice and research is in research along the way, you frequently have to, again, explain to the partners in the research endeavor what it is you're trying to do, why you're going to do it, and then after you've done it, have it reviewed as well. So the research process is very different than the clinical practice of anesthesia, and I think understanding that will help people be successful. It'll also help our clinical colleagues who are essential to support the research endeavor understand the challenges of doing research.
Yeah, great. So let's talk about transfusion triggers. What I was taught and what we, I think, mainly teach our trainees here, and I think in many places, is that most people should be transfused at a hemoglobin of 7, and that if they have coronary artery disease, they should be transfused at a hemoglobin of 8. Is that where do those numbers come from? And, you know, and then I'll just say that for the TRIX3 trial, you used slightly different triggers, 7.5 and 9.5, which then when they got to the ward went down to 8.5. So how did we start at 7 and 8, or why is that taught? And then how did you end up at slightly different triggers for your trial?
Good question. And there are many factors that go into deciding what a transfusion trigger should be. And again, the trial was a comparison of strategies of transfusion more than it was a comparison of actual triggers. So the strategies were, should you be liberal with transfusion or should you be restrictive with transfusion? And so they're philosophies rather than prescriptions.
Yep.
But within that, if one wants to show a difference between two strategies, then there needs to be separation of the groups, because if one did a trial of 8 versus 9, then there wouldn't be much separation between the two groups, and you wouldn't likely show a difference, not because there isn't a difference between the two, just because the ability to show a difference between two groups is reduced.
Right.
So there needs to be separation of the groups, and most people think that that separation in the trigger should be in the 2 to 3 range, because the average hemoglobins of the patients in the groups is actually above the triggers. And so there's even lower separation between the two groups in their actual hemoglobin concentrations during the trial. And then the other thing that I'll say is most of the trials that are trigger-based look at a specific transfusion trigger, but some of the commentary about TRIX3 has been that we should not just solely base transfusions on a number, because there are lots of factors that may go into whether a patient is better off to be transfused or not transfused. And then the final thing that I'll say is, although TRIX3 was a trial of strategies, restrictive versus liberal transfusion, it should not be misinterpreted as a trial advocating for anemia and non-anemia, because the question we were specifically answering was, if a patient becomes anemic to a level of, in this case, 7.5 grams per deciliter, are they better off to be transfused or not transfused? That's not advocating for anemia. In fact, my own belief is that patients are better off to have their own red blood cells in their own system. And what we should do is do everything that we can to preserve the patient's red cells and, in fact, increase their red cell mass so they don't become anemic. So the trial should not be interpreted as advocating for anemia, but rather when one becomes anemic, are you better off to be transfused or not transfused, or are you harmed by one of the other strategies? Now, having said that, the reason that we settled on the trigger that we did was because it ended up being a compromise between many different factions. And some people who interpreted the original TRIC trial said that they're, and based on their own practice, said that the transfusion trigger in TRICS 3 should be lower, 7, 6.5, even lower than that. On the other hand, there were people who were concerned by the TITER 2 trial and said, no, it should actually be higher. And in fact, the granting agency who supported the trial, CIHR, when they first reviewed the trial, said they wouldn't fund us until we could adequately justify that a trigger lower than 8 was not making it unsafe for patients. So in essence, the trigger of 7.5 was a compromise between the ranges of what people interpreted appropriate for restrictive transfusion. Now, whether or not we would get the same results if we had designed the trial with a trigger of 7 or 6.5, we don't know. Many people have said that should be the next trial, but it likely won't be. But in my own view, there is a threshold beyond which the risk of anemia is greater than the risk of transfusion in this group of high, moderate to high-risk patients undergoing cardiac surgery. 7.5 for a transfusion trigger did not confer on them a worse outcome than a liberal trigger.
Right. And so it could be that 7 would be fine, but we didn't answer that question.
We don't know. Yeah, we don't know.
And the kind of 7 for – and also this trial didn't address, you know, medical patients with a GI bleed, right? I
mean, correct.
As far as we know, those patients probably should still have a 7 as a threshold.
Although many of the randomized trials in GI, yes, the restrictive transfusion down to 7 or 7.5 does seem to be – it does seem to result in a similar or better outcome than the liberal transfusion.
Right. And the argument for cardiac surgery patients, or I should say patients with cardiac disease or ischemic heart disease, to be maybe different is that they may have impaired perfusion of their heart compared to someone who doesn't have coronary artery disease and therefore might do better with more oxygen carrying capacity. Is that
correct? So there's two components. One is oxygen delivery to the heart might be impaired if they have coronary artery disease. But even if they don't have coronary artery disease, if they have decreased or diminished cardiac reserve, then maybe they may not be able to generate sufficient oxygen delivery to the tissues.
Mm-hmm.
Again, many trials have shown that transfused blood, it does not maintain or regain its oxygen-carrying capacity for some time. So giving an allogeneic transfusion may not increase the oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood. In fact, in TRICS 2, we did measure mixed venous oxygen saturation prior to and after transfusion in a subgroup of patients, a small subgroup of patients, and the data was striking in the variability of response. Mm. Some patients went up, some patients went down, and even those patients who had very low mixed venous oxygen saturation, some of them went up, but some of them went down as well. And there have been some recent studies of cerebral oxygenation in cardiac surgery patients to try and guide transfusion, done by Gavin Murphy, who was the author of the TITER 2 trial. And that trial did not find that cerebral oxygen monitoring improved outcome. Transfusion based on cerebral oxygen monitoring improved outcome.
Mm.
So there is a sense that something else besides hemoglobin could be or should be used to base transfusion decisions. We just don't know what it is at the moment. And any of the physiologic triggers that are plausible either haven't been shown to be effective or there haven't been large enough trials to say that that physiologic trigger is the trigger we should use.
Gotcha. And so some of the things you mentioned, which kind of maybe, or I think pretty clearly, we know patients who have their own blood and don't need transfusions and don't get anemic, right, they're in good shape. And so things that, you know, you tell me, but I think patients can get, preoperatively can get iron, for example. They can get the use of Cell Saver intraoperatively to try to, you know, get them back some of their own blood cells. Are there other things that you recommend or that you think are worthwhile?
Yeah, well, in the cardiac surgical patients in our institution, we actually have a blood management clinic where a blood management nurse screens all the patients and anybody who's anemic gets evaluated for what the cause of their anemia is and whether this, the operation could be delayed to try and optimize their hemoglobin. And we optimized their hemoglobin with iron, either oral or IV, frequently IV, with or without erythropoietin. Mm-hmm. The issue of erythropoietin is still not totally settled within cardiac surgery, and there are ongoing trials looking at it, although there was a trial published in Lancet recently that suggested that supplementation with iron, vitamins, and EPO significantly reduced transfusion in cardiac surgery, although it was a small study and outcome was not affected. Certainly within the operating room environment, things like Cell Saver, prophylactic antifibrinolytics, hemostatic agents, and surgical meticulousness all help. And then postoperatively, things like restrictive triggers, early return to operating room if there's surgical bleeding, and hemostatic therapy guided by point of care or laboratory-based interventions.
Yeah, that all sounds great. I'm always struck by when we have patients who are Jehovah's Witnesses and don't accept blood transfusions who have cardiac surgery. We're able to be very successful in getting them through that. And part of that is even little things, I think. Like we use smaller tubes to draw blood so that every time they get blood drawn for tests, it's not as much getting taken. Plus all of the things that you mentioned. And I think, you know, you do have to ask the question, why not do it for everybody?
Correct. And so we are what's known as medical vampires in terms of the amount of blood that we take for testing. And many hospitals have tried to use pediatric or reduced blood sampling to do that. So, yes, we should take the same level of care that we do for Jehovah's Witnesses and expand it to the broader population.
So let's talk about the actual TRIX3 trial. And obviously, it was a huge trial, and we're not going to go through all of it. But what would you say are the kind of highlight findings that were new or that, you know, really should affect practice or have affected practice?
So the primary goal of the study was to answer the question of whether restrictive transfusion is safe compared to liberal transfusion in the setting of cardiac surgery in patients who have moderate to high risk of death. And we quite clearly answered that. The restrictive transfusion was non-inferior, that is, not worse than liberal transfusion in all of the outcomes that we looked at, in all of the subgroups that we looked at. And that includes sick patients, because frequently we will hear people say, yes, but my patients are different.
Right.
Yes, but my patients are sicker. But even patients who had very high Euroscores, even patients who had who were on two inotropes, even patients who had renal failure, those patients had this. There was no difference in outcome compared to the overall trial group. Where there was a interaction was with age, but again, that interaction went in the way that was opposite to what we expected. That is, older patients actually did better in the restrictive transfusion group compared to the younger patient group. And this was a surprise to us, but it was consistent in the multiple different analyses that we did. We did it by decades of life. We did it with a cubic spline analysis. Every way that we did it, it was consistent in the six-month outcome and in the early outcome. That is, the older patients, contrary to what most people believed, did better with restrictive transfusion than with liberal transfusion. Now, the New England Journal was quite careful, and we are as well, to say that this is hypothesis generating, but the data clearly indicates that maybe we should reexamine our beliefs that older patients, A, need a higher hemoglobin, and B, need more transfusion than others.
Yeah, that was really striking when you showed those graphs this morning. And, you know, again, not what we're taught. Do you have any idea, and of course we don't know for sure, but any hypotheses as to why older patients may do better with less transfusion?
So, again, we need to be clear that we're not saying that older patients are better to be anemic.
Yep.
What we're saying is that when older patients become anemic, they're not improved by liberal transfusion.
Right.
In fact, it may be that they're harmed by liberal transfusion. So how could that be? And again, it's all hypothesis generating. We don't know for sure, but the data does seem to be consistent. So if it is true, how does that happen? And it may be that older patients are susceptible to either the two-hit or the three-hit model of organ injury. That is, that they may be sensitive to anemia, but when you transfuse them, they may not be able to handle the volume load, or they may not be able to handle the inflammatory components that are present in a unit of blood. So again, it's not that we're advocating older patients should have a low hemoglobin.
Right.
It's when older patients get anemic, there's no evidence to support that they should have more blood than younger patients, more transfusion than younger patients, and potentially, perhaps, they should have less.
Yep, I think that's really interesting. So you had mentioned this morning that the TRIX4 trial is something that we'll probably see at some point, and that is going to take a look at age. Are you allowed to reveal anything about
that? Yes, so we recently were lucky enough to receive funding from CIHR for TRIX4.
Okay,
and
congratulations.
Thank you. Then the TRIX4 proposal is to study the other end of the age spectrum, because just as in older patients indicated that they were better off with restrictive transfusion, there was less of a signal, but some signal that potentially younger patients might have done better with liberal transfusion. So because that observation, especially in the younger patients, is hypothesis generating, we now are planning to study patients less than 65 having moderate to high-risk cardiac surgery with the same triggers as in TRIX3, but in younger patients, to address the question of whether liberal transfusion is really superior to restrictive in that younger cohort than not, or whether the converse question is whether restrictive transfusion is not better than liberal in that younger cohort. So that is the current plan. We hope to begin enrollment sometime next year. And if anybody who's listening wants to participate in that trial, they're welcome to contact me for more information.
That sounds great. And we'll give them a way to get a hold of you in the show notes. So, you know, you do a huge trial like TRIX3. I'm sure you've got both through the New England Journal commentary and I'm sure via email and all kinds of things. I'm sure you get a lot of feedback and input both. You alluded to some of it before. I'm sure a ton of positive and probably some fairly critical. Having read through all that, thinking about it, if you could go back, is there anything now in retrospect, if you could, you'd change about the trial design or the way you did the TRIX3 trial?
I don't think I would change the design of the trial, because I thought it was quite pragmatic and had broad generalizability and applicability, given that it involved essentially every continent in the world. So I think the strength of it was the broad generalizability and the consistency of the results. So I mentioned that there were consistent results both in the subgroup analyses and the sensitivity analyses, but we also looked at whether region or country or healthcare system made a difference, because that's always been a question of whether outcome is affected by that and whether transfusion practice is affected by that. And none of those variables did we observe any difference in the signal. So the signal, the outcome seems very consistent no matter how we've analyzed it. The question of a physiologic trigger integrated into a transfusion trial, I think, is a reasonable one. I don't, even now after having completed TRIX3, I don't know what that physiologic trigger would be, but it is something that could be considered in a future trial.
And when you say physiologic trigger, we think things like heart rate or blood pressure or...
Yeah, or oxygen saturation, mm-hmm. or evidence of specific organ ischemia. That would lead to more of a usual care arm, and some people have suggested that the more you separate groups, the more likely that usual care is in between those groups, and therefore why one might want to have a usual care group in a trial like that. That complicates things and from a design perspective exponentially increases the sample size, so it's not an easy thing to do. That's why I say I don't think I would have changed it for TRIX 3, but in future planning for transfusion trials, people need to think about those things as well.
Interesting. So why do you think there's so much resistance to a restrictive strategy, especially in cardiac surgery? And, I think some surgeons in any area are resistant to a restrictive strategy, but I have found, and I think a lot of us find, that cardiac surgeons especially are resistant to this. They really are known for advocating for higher thresholds for their patients. Why is that?
I think I've learned that transfusion is a very emotional issue.
Yeah.
People seem very tied to their own beliefs about what the right approach to transfusion should be. And in interpretation or reception of the trial, a lot of that pre-existing bias continues. And there's bias both ways. And one of the challenges of doing the trial was engaging sites that had such strong bias. As I mentioned this morning, there were some sites that I went to who said, this is a great trial, we really need the answer, but I can't participate because I don't want my patients in the liberal group. And down the street was another hospital that said, this is a great trial, we really need the answer, but I can't let my patients be in the restrictive group.
Right.
So while there was broad general equipoise about the question, in some individual's mind, there was no equipoise. And so the challenge there, as I mentioned, was to get people to temporarily suspend their firmly held, almost religiously held, but scientifically unsubstantiated beliefs to allow us to address a very important question. And I think those of us in the audience who may participate in future trials, again, need to remember that when there is equipoise about a question, even if you don't have your own personal beliefs, it is important to temporarily suspend those firmly held beliefs to be able to answer that question properly.
Absolutely. That's great advice. All right. My last question is, if you were taking care of a patient post-cardiac surgery in the ICU and you had to pick, what would your threshold be to transfuse that patient? Would it be 7.5 or would it be lower?
My threshold has been 7 to 7.5. Even before I did the TRIX 3 trial, and I'm glad that the trial substantiated that practice is a safe practice to do.
So you stay there.
So I have, my transfusion practice has not changed since the TRIX 3 trial, but that's, as I said, the reason we did the trial was because we wanted to be able to demonstrate that a restrictive transfusion strategy was safe for patients in having cardiac surgery. The other question that I get sometimes is that this was a moderate to high-risk patient population. What about a lower-risk population? Mm-hmm. And our philosophy in studying higher-risk patients was, if a strategy is safe in higher-risk population, then it almost certainly, we don't know for sure, but it almost certainly is safe in a lower-risk population as well.
Absolutely. And then you mentioned this morning that there's an ongoing trial right now looking at patients with active ischemia.
Correct. So one of the questions has always been, if patients have ongoing cardiac ischemia, are they better off with a higher hemoglobin? And again, if they're anemic, are they better off to be transfused to a higher hemoglobin? So there is a trial that's ongoing now, a multi-center international trial called the MINT trial, that is taking patients who have either a recent infarct, myocardial infarction, or have acute coronary syndrome, and randomizing them to either restrictive or liberal transfusion. Well, one might think that's a trial that's based solely in the CCU, or the coronary care unit. It actually is intending to study the patients that we're concerned about, the vascular surgery patient who has a periop MI.
Yeah.
They would like to enroll patients in that trial, again, to answer the question that I think is still not totally answered, and that is, if patients periop or otherwise have an acute MI, are they better off with a restrictive or liberal transfusion strategy? TRICS 3 did have patients with coronary disease, but having undergone CABG surgery, there's not concern, but there is the sense that if they've had repaired coronary disease, then maybe they're different than the patients who have ongoing or acute coronary ischemia. Again, in the subgroup analysis of our study in patients who had CABG surgery, whether or not they had complete revascularization, there was no difference. That is, the signal was consistent, and there was no evidence that a restrictive transfusion was harmful in that group of patients. But the MINT study, which will probably take another couple of years, I would think, is specifically trying to address that question of acute coronary ischemia, both in CCU patients, and hopefully there'll be enough patients that will inform our perioperative practice as well.
Great. Well, that'll be really interesting to see, as well as the TRICS 4 trial when that data is available as well. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This is the part of the show where we make random recommendations on anything and everything that you may want to mention to people. Something you may have, you'll be at a cocktail party this weekend and you'll say, hey, everybody, you should check out X, Y, or Z. So I'll ask you to make a random recommendation to our audience. So what do you have for us?
My recommendation is that mentorship will be really was very important for me in my career, both personal mentorship and professional mentorship, and I still consult my mentors now for advice. And the second piece of advice that I have is to consider your own best interest when making decisions, both personally and professionally. That doesn't mean you have to decide what is, make a selfish decision, but make sure that a decision that you make incorporates a consideration of what is in your best interests as well.
I think that's great advice and a great recommendation to make. I'm going to go with one thing I've already mentioned, but I just want to remind people of, again, a little self-serving for the podcast here, but remember to check out at the American Society of Anesthesiologists meeting. We will be doing interviews with Dr. Jeffrey Cooper on the communication and relationship between anesthesiologists and surgeons, which should be really interesting. He's giving a talk on that. And then with Dr. Wiener Kronisch, who's the chair at MGH, talking about personalized PEEP. And she's giving the John Severinghouse lecture on that topic. So both will be interesting. And I'm going to, again, a little log rolling, but recommend those when they come out. And then my other random recommendation for folks out there, if you've never tried an Instant Pot for cooking, we have really gotten into this in my household. It's like a pressure cooker, slow cooker combined, and you can really make some delicious stuff really fast. So if you're pressed for time and you want some delicious food, you can make it home. Check out the Instant Pot.
I would agree with that.
Awesome. All right. Dr. Mazur, again, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay, thanks. Pleasure being here.
All right. That was really fantastic. I learned a ton. I hope you did too. Go to the website, acrac.com, and let us know what you thought. If you have questions, you can leave them there. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. You can follow us at ACRAC Podcast, and I'm at Jay Wolpaw. That's J-W-O-L-P-A-W. You can also join the Facebook group. It's the ACRAC Facebook group, where you can join the conversation and let us know what you think about this and all of the episodes. If you're a fan of the show, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you're interested in supporting the making of the show, you can go to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. Also, you can make a donation anytime at paypal.me/acrac. Huge thank you to those who are already patrons and have already made donations. A big thank you, as always, to Brian Park for the outlines he does for the shows. Our amazing intern is Kimia Cash Cooley. Thanks for all you are doing for the show. And, of course, our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. Check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. David Mazur, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.